This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
Hey guys, it's Candace.
And it's Elena.
And you're listening to Cousins on Crime. Listening to Clickety Clackety Samity Sam.
So sorry.
I saw that. These dog crocs.
Yes.
They've made dog crocs. Did I send it to you?
You did.
Okay. I was like, Sam needs these.
Yeah.
Because it would just be like marshmallow sounds.
Instead of the clickety clack.
Instead of the clickety clack.
Really, I just need to get his nails trimmed, but.
Who's got the time?
Who?
You know what I mean? Like, he can trim his own nails.
Right.
Like, pull your weight around here.
Yeah. Chew your own nails.
Oh, Lena. If Scott Peterson doesn't get out of my feed, I think I'm just going to go. Rage.
Can't you do like the do not see these posts anymore kind of
thing?
Well,
I want to know. Like, I want to know. But, you know, he was recently granted a win for his team, which is they're going to test the evidence. This evidence that he didn't bother presenting at the trial 20 years ago.
Right.
Anyway, it doesn't matter. It's not going to be linked to Lacey in any way, shape, or form. And so he's not going to get a new trial. I don't believe he's going to get a new trial. This is ridiculous. 20 years later, come on.
I know.
Just stop. And his stupid face. I've tried watching the Peacock interview with him.
Oh, yeah.
And his little Cheshire cat. Grin where his like
oh yeah I know what you're talking about
disappears and his buck teeth, that's all you can see, and I'm just like, get your face out of here.
I mean, you have to give him kudos for like fighting for his life, I guess.
He just wants to be seen. He's like, oh, look at my slick back hair. Look at me. I can't stand him. Anyways, more on that later. So I guess we'll just, you know, take off all our clothes and jump right into the pool. Well,
okay.
I'm
jumping in.
Yeah. So, the case I have for you tonight is a twisty one. It was a snowy night in St. Charles, Missouri.
Uh-huh.
Say Missouri or Missouri?
Depends who you're talking to.
Okay. Well, I say Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
On October 19th, 1983.
Mm.
When a witness was driving down an empty road, he saw a car stopped ahead on the roadside, but that's not really what grabbed his attention. It was the fire on the ground next to the car.
Well, that would be pretty alarming.
It's like, yeah, that's what alarmed him. He was like, it was snowing. It like the grass was like wet. And he's like, how did this, the car wasn't on fire? It was just like a grass fire next to it. So he was like, what's going on? And he carefully approached the stopped car, and he realized that the front end of the car was kind of tilted down into the nearby ravine.
Okay.
So he got out of his vehicle to check inside, and really, he thought he was going to go around to the driver's side and see someone who just was, like, stuck in there.
Oh.
He didn't expect to see any injury, but when he got to the driver's side door was wide open.
Oh.
And he could see someone like wadded up down in the floorboard.
Okay.
And she was like struggling
like
to breathe.
Like the driver's side
floorboard?
Yeah,
like the driver's side.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And he was like, what is going on here? So he got on his CB radio, you know, back in the day, your dad. This is what I thought of your dad. And he contacted police. So he called police from his CB radio.
Good to have one of those back in those days.
Exactly. And so he was like, y'all got to get here quick. So when first responders arrived, they found a Cadillac with its front end in the Frosty Creek and realized that the victim was unconscious. They too felt like her condition was incongruent with just running off of the road. Her head was under the dash and her feet were like up towards the passenger seat.
Yeah, make it make sense.
Yeah, they're like, how? So it almost seemed like she may have been sitting in the passenger seat and then went head first down into the driver's footwell, if that makes sense.
Okay.
But there was no time to figure this out. Like, they're like, she needs help. We've got to get going on this. So Detective Copeland, who was actually an officer at the time, assessed the victim and went to try to open her airways because she wasn't, I mean, she was struggling to even take one breath. But as he placed his hand on the back of her head, he realized she had a traumatic injury to the back of her head.
Oh, no.
Yeah. He was interviewed by Oxygen's show Exhumed, and he described the back of her head feeling like mush in his hand.
Oh, no.
Yeah. He's like, what the heck? Like, how did that happen?
Yeah.
And that's saying a lot for an officer who responds to scenes all the time, and he's probably seen it all, and you know, they're not exactly surprised by most things, but
that's something that would stick with you.
These little things here are not adding up. She was still alive, so he knew he needed to get her out of that car, and she needed far more help than he was going to be able to give her.
Right.
So she was rushed from the scene by ambulance to St. Joseph's Healthcare Center. Once the victim had left the scene, I imagine they're all standing there and there's like this big adrenaline dump. Like they're like, oh, okay, the victim is in good hands.
Right.
Let's take a breath. And now we've got to figure out what is this? There was no skid marks at the scene at first glance. The car hadn't hit anything.
Right.
Other than that, the embankment, like down in that little ditch. Speaking of which, there wasn't very much damage to the front of the car, like it had hit something. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
The creek that the car's front end was in was shallow, so it's like she had swerved maybe to avoid something in the road, and she was going at a slow rate of speed because her car might have been further into the ravine.
Okay.
Had, and I'll post pictures on our Patreon so you guys can see like what I'm talking about, but the car was not submerged. It wasn't very far out into the water.
So strange.
And if that were the case, that injury to the back of her head just can't be explained. What did she hit her head on and how?
Yeah.
So other than learning the identity of the driver, there wasn't too much more at the scene to help shed light on the truth. Inside the purse in the back seat was the ID of a Sharon Williams. She was 42 years old, lived local. She actually just lived a few miles away. So maybe she was on her way back home and this accident occurred and her family was waiting for her. So they thought they'd just go over and speak with her family since they were right by there. When they arrived, Sharon's husband, Jim, answered the door, and when they told him what happened, he was distraught. He was like, you know, she was just here. Like, I don't understand this. How could this happen? He told officers that she had been gone for about an hour. So he ended up calling Sharon's mom and their youngest son, you know, to tell them what happened. And Sharon was said to be very loving and very giving, always eager to help other people. She was born September 28th, 1940, to parents Ray and Alice Almerode. Hope I'm saying that right. Her family said that she would literally give you the shirt off her back. She was just so kind. She put others first. And she met her husband, Jim, while they were in high school, riding the bus. Isn't that, that so cute?
Why is it always the best people?
Why? Lena, it's like you're reading my notes.
I am.
Jim worked as an electrical contractor and Sharon worked for the TWA as a reservation agent. TWA. Ooh. Does anybody remember the TWA? At the time of the accident, they had two grown boys.
Okay.
After receiving the news of Sharon's accident, her family rushed to the hospital to be with her, you know, when she woke up. I'm not sure to what extent they were knowledgeable about her injuries before they arrived at the hospital. Mm. They may have been hopeful. I don't know. But the doctors had done pretty much everything they could do. And they broke the news to the family. And, you know, they explained to her husband, she's on life support. We can leave her on life support. But he was like, no, let's just take her off. I mean, I don't want her to be like that. No autopsy was performed at the time.
Why? With a head injury like that?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it was the 80s.
Okay.
This isn't too completely out of the ordinary. It was a rural area. No foul play was really suspected. The cause of death listed on her autopsy was blunt craniocerebral trauma, and the manner was accidental. Accidental is not a manner. Accident. Sorry, guys.
Get it right.
Get it right. And that would be the end of it. That would have been the end of it if it weren't for an eager rookie, Officer Copeland.
Oh, thank you.
See, it was the head wound. It was that head wound. Yeah, like it is for us.
We need answers.
Yeah. He really couldn't let it go. And you know what? He wasn't the only one. Sharon's 19-year-old son, Brett, also felt like something was not adding up.
Yeah. As a child, I would want to know.
Yeah.
What is this about?
He wasn't police. I mean, he didn't have any medical background or anything, but he was just like, how did she get hit on the back of the head if the front of her car went into the creek? He's like, that doesn't
add up.
A 19-year-old boy. He's like, this just doesn't make sense. So Brett took his concerns to his dad. He was like, how did she die when it wasn't that bad of an accident? Like, how did she die? I just don't understand. Should we be asking more questions? Like, should we go to the police and ask more questions?
Yes, yes, you should.
And his father's reaction to his curiosity was not one he expected. He was told it was an accident, and that's that.
Okay, get over it.
Yeah, let's move on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Officer Copeland, having only been on the force for 2 years, plucked up the courage to go to his boss with his nagging suspicion. That took some guts. I mean, I gotta say, surprisingly, he wasn't shot down. You know, you've got this guy who's only been on the force for 2 years going to his boss going, hey, we gotta do something about this.
Yeah.
But his boss agreed. St. Charles County Police hired an accident reconstructionist to run an experiment. They used a dummy and the same make and model car that Sharon was driving at the time of the accident. They did their best to recreate the accident the way they believed it happened. And the accident reconstructionist wrote up a report saying, yep, she could have hit a tree, which produced enough speed to launch her into the creek, causing that traumatic head wound and ultimately causing her death.
Okay, so there wasn't, she hit a tree.
He's saying she could have hit a tree. But I don't know what a tree's talking about because I've seen pictures of the scene and it's just a roadside. Like there weren't a bunch of trees around. So,
okay.
Anyhow, this expert concluded that it was an accident and there wasn't really any evidence to suggest that there was any suspicious circumstances.
Well, because that's the easy way to do it.
Yeah. I mean, let's just call it an accident.
Yeah. Here's your answer.
Yeah. A couple days later, Sharon was buried in local Fountain Church Cemetery. Her friends and family braved the frigid temperatures to say goodbye one last time, just still reeling from their sudden loss. And Lena, as you said earlier, they're probably asking themselves, why is it always the good ones?
Why?
Why her? Why her? And slowly, everyone put one foot in front of the other and moved forward the best they could. In the months after Sharon died, Jim didn't talk about it much, even though his son Brett was in extreme pain from the loss of his mother. Mm. I mean, Brett was in some of his most formative years as a 19-year-old boy.
Sure.
And he missed his mom. I mean, he needed her at that time. Every day, instead of like time healing all wounds, it seemed to get worse with the passage of time. Something that probably didn't help matters. Britt's dad remarried pretty quickly.
Oh, what?
Yeah. And it seemed pretty hasty to be getting married. But the woman he married, Joanne, had been someone that he leaned on after Sharon's death. She had also lost her spouse as well, and they had been spending a lot of time together. So Brett still felt kind of gross about it. She wasn't his mother, yet there she was, all moved in.
Oh, wow.
And wearing his mother's jewelry.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. He noticed she was like sitting at the dinner table one time wearing her watch.
No.
And he was like, no. Like, what is this?
I just don't think I could.
And I bet he didn't say anything to his dad because of the reaction he got the last time he went to his dad with something that concerned him, you know?
Oh, wow.
I can't imagine having to swallow that hurt and anger and just move on and like coexist in this situation. So 4 years later, Officer Copeland still couldn't let Sharon's case go. I mean, he never forgot about her.
Aww.
And by now, St. Charles County had stepped it up a notch because they had a forensic neuropathologist as the chief medical examiner.
Oh.
A Dr. Mary Case.
Okay.
You see, Lena, you're going to like this. Before Dr. Case took over in the medical examiner's office, they had a chiropractor as their county coroner.
Because they had a doctorate degree or?
You know, it's my understanding was it was an elected position.
Oh.
And so that was as good as they had available that was in the running.
Okay.
Apparently you didn't like.
I mean, they know anatomy. So
yeah, and apparently you don't have to be a doctor to be the county coroner.
And I've heard that before.
Yeah, I don't know. And maybe it's different in different counties, but in St. Charles County at the time, this is how it was. So after being introduced to Dr. Case, Ed Copeland wanted to get this case file in front of her. She seemed, you know, like sprightly and eager. She agreed to look at the stack of binders and review the reports. And in her review, she immediately noticed that head injury. Being inconsistent with someone hitting their head in a head-on car accident.
Okay.
She knew the only way to do a thorough examination of the case was to see Sharon's body for herself.
Okay.
So she submitted a request to a judge for approval to exhume the body, but it was ignored.
Oh.
For whatever reason. I don't know why. Months
lost
passed.
In the shuffle.
Maybe. Maybe it was like purposefully ignored. I don't know. She didn't know. But months passed and her exhumation request still wasn't being approved or even responded to for that matter.
Frustrating.
And she didn't know why, but she wasn't just going to sit around and wait. So she decided she was going to exhume Sharon's body anyways.
What? Oh.
Without permission from a judge.
Better to ask for forgiveness than permission.
I guess. So she was going to do an illegal exhumation. Have you ever heard of anybody doing an illegal exhumation?
No.
How
brave.
I know.
Wow.
Dr. Case just had this gut feeling that something wasn't right. And she may not have been there for Sharon when she died, but she was here now, and now she was involved
okay,
in this
girl.
Thing. Despite her motivation to seek the truth, though, she knew she could get into some hot water.
Yes. And
she was new to the position. So she needed to proceed carefully, really carefully. First, she wanted to speak with Sharon's family. She knew that their is a natural reluctance for families to agree to exhuming their loved ones. But she really believed that they would want to know what happened to her and their suspicions. And after speaking to Sharon's son, Brett, she felt the hesitation, naturally. He just didn't want to disturb his mother, but he knew that he wanted answers to those nagging feelings.
And this
that,
person is willing to.
I know, exactly. You've got someone like in a position to do something. So Dr. Case didn't expect an indifference from the husband, though. Jim just wanted to let sleeping wives lie.
Sure.
His attitude was like, well, I don't see the point, but like, whatever.
Wow. What a guy.
It almost seems like if Brett hadn't been there for this conversation, Jim might not have supported the idea at all. So without permission from a judge, but with shaky permission from Sharon's family.
Wow.
Investigators gathered to exhume Sharon's body. Luckily, when they raised it out of the ground, her casket was like in really good shape. And when they opened it, she was dry. She was like in the most ideal shape that you would hope to find an exhumed body in.
Wow.
Because then you can just like, you can see things for what they are. And thank God she was not cremated.
Oh, yeah.
Can you imagine? So Dr. Case performed an autopsy. She first noticed two superficial abrasions on Sharon's face, which she'd expect to see in someone who had been involved in a car accident, but they weren't substantial for someone who had been in a like front end collision. Like they were just a couple scrapes on her face. But that wound to the back of the head, though, turns out there were two very long side by side, almost vertical lacerations, almost parallel to each other, with corresponding fractures in her skull. Not consistent with her car hitting a tree and going headfirst into a ravine. This was textbook blunt force trauma.
Like what would she have hit her head on? The headrest of the seat?
And even then, that wouldn't have caused those injuries.
Right.
So blunt force trauma was her cause of death and the manner was now homicide.
Okay.
Because a car accident would not have caused those particular injuries. There's just no way they could make sense of that. So now what? Dr. Case and now Detective Copeland were so committed to taking another look at Sharon's body. And now that they have, they've determined she didn't die an accidental death. Well, now they're in a murder investigation. So
more paperwork for you. Sorry. Right.
And whoever did this has years on them. You know, we talk about this all the time, you know, all the evidence could be lost, but luckily there is a formula to these things, right? You start with the people or the person closest to the victim. In this case, her husband, Jim. The guy seemed pretty indifferent when she died. Detectives remembered that. He married soon after, didn't really care to entertain the thought that his wife didn't die accidentally. When questioned by his son, it was now 1987 and Jim was living in the same house with his new wife. And after speaking with friends and neighbors, they were getting some pretty interesting information about Jim and that new wife of his.
Okay.
Seems like Jim and Joanne go way back. You know that whole thing about them leaning on each other, losing their significant others?
Okay.
Not exactly how that happened.
Okay.
Methinks Joanne had been in the picture before Sharon died. No one likes a cheater, okay? But that doesn't make him a murderer, and detectives knew that. That was until they learned something that sent the investigation into a whole new direction.
Okay.
You know how I said Joanne also lost her spouse?
Yeah, I'm sitting over here thinking, oh, what happened to her spouse?
It was more like he disappeared 2 months after Sharon died in that faux car accident. Joanne's husband, Walter Scott, was something of a local celebrity. He was the front man for Bob Cuban and the Inmen, and he traveled around the local area playing clubs. Their hit song, Cheater, ironically enough, reached number 12 in the Billboard charts in 1966, and they were some hot stuff.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Walter was a bit of a ladies' man. He was cute, you know, with his little cardigan and his white shirt underneath, his butt chin. Oh. You know, he was very fashionable for the time. I bet Granddad jammed out to that song. But, you know, the band was really a one-hit wonder. And though Walter continued to play gigs all over town and tried to relive his glory days, he never had another hit song.
Mm.
Walter had a wife and a small child, but he was carrying on an affair with a woman named Joanne Calcutta at the time.
Oh.
And Joanne had her grips on him. Oh, yes, she did. His family did not like her at all.
Mm.
And they were really disappointed that he would leave his beautiful family that he had to start a new one with this snake woman. They didn't get a good vibe from her at all. And well, I guess Walter thought so too, because he started sleeping with one of his dancers after he married Joanne. So, but no love lost though, because Joanne was hooking up with Jim Williams.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Sharon's husband.
Right.
So it was December 27th, 1983, just a couple of months after Sharon died, when Walter went missing. The Christmas tree was still up. The new year was right around the corner. Joanne called the police to report that he had gone out to get a new car battery and he just never came home. She said that he didn't return after some time, so she called the mechanic that he was supposed to go to say, are y'all done or whatever? And the mechanic said he never showed up. Though he'd been reported missing, Walter's dad wasn't too concerned because, listen, his son was a traveling musician.
Okay.
And he didn't really like his wife. So he didn't particularly know his schedule, but he knew his son would come and go. So the next day, after police found Walter's car at St. Louis Airport, but no Walter and no record of him flying anywhere, I think that's when his parents got concerned, because they were like,
at some point,
this doesn't check. So they went to Joanne's house, like Joanne and Walter's house, mm-hmm. to check on her and like see what was going on. When they arrived, though, there was a man sitting at the dinner table. It was Jim Williams.
Oh my gosh.
He was sitting at the dining table going through Walter's jewelry box.
Shut your mouth.
And he was like looking it over with one of those like, a little
eyeglass
things, like almost like he was valuing the pieces.
Oh my goodness.
What's more, did you like that?
Did
it make me sound really like professional? Yeah. Okay. What's more, two of Walter's guns were sitting right there on the table, two of the three that he owned. And Walter's dad thought that was strange. He was like, and Jim was like, well, I just wanted to see him.
What are these people's deal, man?
I don't know. So all this was concerning to investigators, of course, but when they found out that Joanne had called around to cancel Walter's gigs after he disappeared or left town, quote unquote, I mean,
that's not normal.
That was it for them. They were like, what? How do you know he's not going to make it back?
Right.
In time for his shows. Maybe he cares more about making it to his shows than he cares about coming home to dinner to be with you. You don't know. So when Joanne suddenly moved on with someone else so quickly, her own family thought that was strange. I mean, it was about 9 months after Walter went missing when Joanne filed for divorce, citing abandonment, and married Jim Williams.
Interesting.
Yeah. Police didn't want to spook Jim and Joanne and let them know that they'd uncovered like all this incriminating information.
Pointing, yeah, like we're on to you.
Yeah, like pointing to, we know what's going on. So they kind of tiptoed around them to learn what, if anything, they could dig up from those closest to the couple. Maybe someone who lived in the home with them.
Oh.
They learned that James Jr., Sharon and Jim's oldest son, was in prison at the time of this investigation. I don't know what he was in for. I tried to find it, but detectives thought, well, maybe this gives us a little bit of leverage. Like, maybe he knows something and will tell us in exchange for a lighter punishment.
Okay. Hey, so, worth a try.
Yeah. James Jr. did remember something. He told detectives that after his mom died, he remembered his dad covering up this old cistern that was in their yard with a big flower pot, this big flower bed. Now, that cistern had been exposed in their backyard his whole life. It was probably one of those things that he remembers playing around as a kid. You know, yeah. It's probably one of those things like mine would be the propane tank.
Yeah, yeah.
In Granbury, you know, like we would sit on it and pretend it was a hippopotamus. Anywho. April 21st, 1987, investigators got a warrant to search Jim Williams' property. And of course, they went straight to that cistern in the backyard mm-hmm. that sure enough, there was this big old round, like wooden flower box built. It was kind of like the size of a large kiddie pool, round kiddie pool. So they dug out the dirt from this flower box and moved it aside, and there was a slab of concrete under it
mm-hmm.
that had been laid over the cistern opening. But once they broke through that and they looked down in the hole, there was a blue tarp wrapped in rope shaped like a body floating in the water below.
No.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. This whole time.
They were certain who that body belonged
yes.
to.
Yes.
He was even wearing the same clothing that Joanne had described Walter in the last time she saw him.
These people.
It was a blue tracksuit with the, you know, the stripes going down the legs.
Ugh.
Also down in the cistern was a bag of Walter's credit cards and some of his personal effects. Now, at autopsy, it was determined that Walter had been shot in the back with a high-velocity round. Dr. Case, who did Sharon's autopsy, performed Walter's autopsy, and she described how this projectile had splintered into tons of pieces in his body. Think Paul Murdoch.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
May he rest. Walter's parents were able to bury their son after 3 years of not knowing what had happened to him. They actually buried him in a mausoleum. Like, I don't know. I just imagine like these podunk people being buried in like a pauper's grave and Walter gets a mausoleum. Sweet justice. Now Sharon's body, well, it was exhumed again.
Again.
This time legally.
Okay.
This time for a proper autopsy with proper documentation, something that was going to hold up in court.
Now, was Jim home when the cistern was examined or dug up? Or?
I don't know. But you know what? Jim blamed his own son.
You've got to be kidding me. That is so disgusting.
I am not. He's like, kind of funny how he knew where the body was. But he couldn't explain why there was a body in his own backyard. He's like, I can't explain that, but kind of funny my son knew where it was.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Jim and Joanne were arrested. Jim was charged with the murder of Walter Scott and his wife, Sharon Williams, and Joanne was charged with the murder of her husband, Walter Scott. They were tried separately, which I can't believe they still try people together these days.
Yeah.
But at Jim's trial, prosecutors described how Jim probably killed Sharon after a fight about this affair he was having. He likely hit her in the head with a long cylindrical object, causing those vertical lacerations to the back of her head, and drove her down in her own car down into the ditch to stage this car accident.
Mm.
Now, he took gas. Okay. Remember that little fire?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he didn't just douse the grass. He also poured gasoline inside the car.
Oh.
In fact, nurses testified that she smelled like gasoline when she came into the hospital.
Okay.
So he was hoping that that car was just going to burst into flames.
Right.
The jury listened to testimony from Jim's neighbors who said he was pouring that slab of concrete in his backyard in a snowstorm. Who does that?
Mm-mm.
I mean, we're not from like up north, but I imagine that you just don't do stuff like that in those months
right.
of the year when it's like a snowstorm. I also read in a court document that a couple months before Sharon's murder, Jim had asked one of his employees if he knew any hitmen. And it wasn't just that simple. They had like this whole conversation
no.
like, I'll pay you $5,000 if you can find someone. And yeah.
That's what gets me. These people.
And he thought he was joking.
Oh, why?
Guys.
It's not a joke. It's not
no
a joke.
No one's ever joking about that. Okay. No one's ever joking about
never.
That. I promise you. I promise.
It's
no one's ever joking about that. The physical evidence in the case, though, was pretty weak. The ropes used to tie Walter's body up in that tarp didn't match those found in Jim's home. And there wasn't any other evidence linking him to Sharon's death.
Mm.
Jim took the stand in his own defense, because like Alex Murdoch, he thought he was smarter than everybody
no.
else. But listen, mm-hmm. the circumstantial evidence was enough for the jury. And he was found guilty of 2 counts of murder and received life in prison without the possibility of parole.
Bye.
Joanne never saw her day in court, though.
What?
Yeah. She reached a plea agreement.
Of course she did. What a coward.
I can't stand, I mean, I'm a woman, but I cannot stand how light some women get off on their part in a crime.
And she probably said it was all Jim's decision and
well,
plan.
Well, they told her, we'll drop the murder charges or charge. Well, there was more than one murder charge for Walter. If she'd plea to the felony count of hindering the investigation. And so I think she thought she'd have a better shot at freedom than taking the gamble on a jury trial. They knew, too, in the prosecutor's office that their case was pretty weak,
mm-hmm.
especially against Joanne, because if they didn't have the physical evidence in Jim's trial, they sure as heck didn't have it
yeah.
for Joanne. And so I think they weren't confident enough to take her to trial, which is why they offered her the deal. She got 5 years in prison, and she paid a $5,000 fine. But she was released after serving 18 months in prison. And she went on her merry way to Target and Chick-fil-A. Yeah, she's a convicted felon, but who isn't, you know?
No words. No words.
Yeah.
What?
And that's the end of the story.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Just wild. Just why?
Sounds like Joanne is someone who goes after what she wants and it doesn't matter.
And she looks like a wretch. Like, she's not Miss Americana in the Homecoming King or whatever the song is. She is not it.
Oh,
anyways.
And then she got exactly what she wanted.
She did.
With
some
everything.
Some women are like that, though. They're,
yeah.
you know, like they're so manipulative and.
That's so disgusting.
My heart breaks for Sharon's children.
And Walter's family.
And Walter's family. I mean, yeah, it's just because two people were so selfish. Just get a divorce. Like, I'm serious. Like, if I could give you some unsolicited advice.
Right.
Just get a divorce, okay?
It's much better than killing someone.
Nothing is worse than murdering someone.
I cannot wrap my brain around it.
Yeah. Anyway, that's it for that. And that's the that on that.
Well, I still have no extra words. So we'll leave it at that. Oh, my gosh.
I know.
Well, that was great. Let's do it again sometime.
Let's do it.
Okay.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Cousins on Crime. Get connected with us by becoming a free member on our Patreon. Or for just $5 a month, you'll have access to bonus episodes, discussion groups, and much more. If you can't afford $5 a month, we get it. Inflation, am I right? Please consider leaving us a positive review and rating wherever you listen.
And don't forget merch. Support our podcast and show the love by sporting t-shirts with our latest designs or grab an evidence bag to keep the chain of custody for all your valuables. Don't forget to follow our show on your favorite streaming app so you never miss an episode, and get photos and updates on our Instagram at Cousins on Crime Podcast or our Cousins on Crime Facebook page. Have a case suggestion? Email us at cousinsoncrime@gmail.com.